My name is Mary Schramm, and this is the third in a series this week on gentle justice toward a healthy spirituality. If you've been in any of John's sessions so far this week or last week, you will remember that he always put a diagram on the board. In the middle, in a circle, were the words gentle justice, and around the circle were word, world, community, and solitude. My own definition of spirituality that I'm going to be using this evening is the way you live out your life. And as John has pointed out in each of his sessions, what is in the center of your spirituality, whatever the core is, that will be the way that you live in your community, in the world. That's the way you will approach the word. That's what you will do in your time of solitude and contemplation. And so because the theme at Holden this summer is gentle justice, we have chosen to put gentle justice at the core of our spirituality. And I realized I have done this session before at Holden, and those of you that may have been here in years past have certainly heard at least parts of this, but it fit the theme so beautifully this year, because I think that's always what I have been talking about, insufficiency as gentle justice. Tonight, sufficiency as a lifestyle or sufficiency as gentle justice will touch word, world, and community. It won't have a lot to do with solitude. And I would remind you that John has been telling us that perhaps growth for us is to move into one of those areas on the circle where we don't often find ourselves. If we're always very, very busy in the world and we're never quiet, maybe we need to strengthen that part of our life where we do spend some time in solitude. You look like the Pink Panther, Tom, creeping up here. I would like to begin with a brief text. Micah 6, verse 8. What does the Lord require of you but to do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with your God? How do you do justice? How do each of you in your life do gentle justice? Now, I suppose there could be many answers to that. But I would like to suggest that the way we do justice is to start where we have the most power, and that is with our lifestyles. That we begin to see the connections between the way that we live as first world North American citizens and our connections with those in our world who live in a very unjust system. And I suppose the topic tonight will meet with more resistance than any other session in this series. We all somehow want justice to happen. We want our government to be just. We want to see that the oppressors stop oppressing the oppressed. We may even work in food shelters or with food shelves or work in shelters, or we may give money for bread for the world, or we may study the scripture and find out how Jesus aligned himself with the poor and the oppressed. We are always trying to see ways of doing justice, but it is so hard for us to change the way that we live. And so I find when I go around talking about the subject of sufficiency as gentle justice that it's met with an awful lot of resistance. If you want peace in the world, you have to start working for justice. And there is a man who used to work with Lutheran World Federation. His name is Jürgen Listner, and he came up with some very helpful reasons for changing our lifestyle. He said, to change your lifestyle is not a panacea. It's not going to bring the kingdom of God. It's not going to make the whole world just. But it is one place where we as individuals can begin to do justice. The four reasons that he gives for changing our lifestyle are faith, freedom, sharing and solidarity, and witness and provocation. And so I'd like to begin with the idea of changing your lifestyle because of a faith reason. Now, it's very important that you have a starting point. If many of you in here are Lutherans, your reason for changing your lifestyle might be guilt. We feel very guilty about many things, and we beat our chests and say, oh, how could I be so terrible? I am 6% of the world's population, and we use 35 to 40% of the world's goods. Why am I such a terrible person? I must change the way I live because I feel so guilty. And so we may change our lifestyles, but we live feeling very deprived. Oh, I would really like to take that trip, but I can't. I'd like to buy that new car, but oh, it would just add more guilt to my shoulders, so I dare not make that purchase. Or perhaps we say, I would like to change my lifestyle out of necessity. It's just very important. I can see that if 6% of us use 35% of the world's goods, that means only 18% of the world can live in the manner which we live. And so I have to. I do it out of necessity, and then we live with some kind of stoic resignation, especially if we're German or Scandinavian. And we grit our teeth and say, I don't like a lot of this, but I think it's really necessary to do it. Or we start changing our lifestyle, and we do it. All of a sudden, we realize that we're very prideful people, and we say, as I sometimes do, I am really changing my lifestyle. I bought this blouse at Goodwill for $2. I grow my own sprouts in a jar underneath my dark sink. I don't even buy sprouts at the grocery store. We haven't eaten meat in months. And there is nothing more disgusting to be with than a simpler-than-thou person. That attitude is not something that is contagious and where people say, oh, I'd love to live the way you do. No, I avoid those people as much as I can. The reason I would like to have us change our lifestyles is because of a faith reason, because of metanoia, that Greek word that means conversion. I am going one way, and all of a sudden the prophets point out something, or God's spirit kind of makes me uncomfortable inside, or I realize that I want to change, and all of a sudden God has spoken to me, and I say, my goodness, I can't keep walking down the same way that I have all the time, and so I make a complete about face, and I start going the other way. And I do it because it is a matter of my faith, because at the center of my spirituality is that gentle justice, and I cannot and I dare not live any other way because I want to be one of God's disciples. And so I have a conversion experience. And I begin to see through the eyes of faith that God is talking about the reality of shalom, that beautiful Hebrew word that means peace that's used 250 times in the Old Testament. It means so many things, you wonder how you can get a handle on it. But basically, shalom means something outward, not concealed. It is a social concept in which I realize that I have to fit into a world that God has created, a world in which there is enough, which there is sufficiency for everyone. And if you see differently, then you will realize your connectedness to other parts of the world, to other people in the world, and to very nature itself. I have a favorite poet. His name is James Carroll. He was a Paulus priest. He left the priesthood and is now writing very popular novels and plays for Broadway. I don't especially care for his novels now, but when he was still a priest, I think he has written some of the most beautiful poetry and books on contemplation that I have ever read. This poem is called The Lord's Is the Earth. The Lord's is the earth and the fullness thereof, perhaps. I do know it's not mine. I wander out beyond the last outpost of our easy time together, past fields oozing corn, past a dead leaf curling, past a ditch of closed flowers, past a fox dragging his paw, and I come to the bare bough where last April a bird sang. And I begin my low humming, I cling to it all again, and I know that this earth owns me. The branch is my master. How do we presume to claim for ourselves or for our children dirt that leaves have labored over, or that low hill that is an ancient, broken-hearted mountain worn away by long erosion, white tides of snow? Who owns the rivers unseen that run in the bowels of the earth, that lubricate the axis of the world? Getty? Gulf? Humble. When I was a child, dirt and dry leaves were my first friends. I sat with them bouncing, talking, before I knew what playing was. And I remember the summer day when a lady yelled at me, shoved me from her dirt, from her yard, from her dry leaves. Oh, something wrong was done that day, and I thought that I had done it. And I ran away in my shame with fear that was new, having learned my first lesson in who really owns the earth. Oh, you can say the Lord's is the earth if you want to, but let him try to picnic where it's posted. Who owns the earth? Getty? Gulf? Humble? Or that mean lady of my early fright and shame? The firmament of stability, the foundation of the universe, the source of all fertility, the womb, the tomb, the green planet, we learn to think of it as property or real estate, if it's for sale. But if we have awakened to the earth, we may be in trouble because it belongs to someone else. We may use the sidewalk and the street and those scabs of concrete assigned to playing, but if we exult in harvest now, we are trespassing, and that mean lady this time might have a gun. If we allow the soil to stir our souls, we may be changed. We may learn what we once knew, that dirt and dry leaves own us. It was very much men and women like you and me who cried, "The Lord's is the earth and the fullness thereof." They were probably trying to say more about each other than about God. To say the land is the Lord's is not to say that he is the landlord. The earth and its children know. The old men and women who own nothing, the defeated, the sharecroppers, the starving, the peasants who have to trespass everywhere. The Lord's is the earth, and it is full enough for everyone. It waits for us to learn again. If we begin to change our lifestyles as an act of faith, we won't be discouraged with the small steps that we take. Because we are literally saying, "I'm just going to take my stance right here. The buck stops with me. Here I stand. I can't do anything else. God help me." And it's probably not going to bring in the kingdom of God, and it's not going to bring justice on the earth, but I can no longer participate because I understand the word shalom, that God created enough for everyone. The second reason, besides faith, for changing our lifestyle is one of freedom. If you're going to change the lifestyle that you have, for goodness sakes, change the things that enslave you. The things that make you feel uncomfortable and keep you tied down to the same job, or those other reasons why we feel we can't make a career move, or we can't take time off, or whether it's a kid who's going to college or a mortgage or whatever it is. It's very sad when I have a pastor friend who says, "I would love to take another call, but quite frankly, I can't move now because I own our house and the mortgage values are not where they ought to, or the property values are not where they ought to be, and I'd lose so much money, and so I really feel stuck in this position." The things that enslave you are so subtle that we don't even realize them sometimes. I recommend a book to you. It's called Following Christ in a Consumer Society by John Francis Cavanaugh. Orbis publishes it. And the subtitle is The Spirituality of Cultural Resistance. And in this book, John Cavanaugh says that the average preschooler will watch television 64% of his or her time. Now, the average American television is on 7 hours a day in this country. That means we would probably watch 6 years of advertisement in our lifetime. 6 years of having the television tell us that we need to do something else, or we need to change, or that Datsun saves, or you can have a trouble-free relationship with your AMC car, or whatever it is. Kavanaugh says things like, we are taught to be unsure about ourselves, our sexuality. Our bodies are continually portrayed as hopelessly, disgustingly inadequate, marred by lumps and acne, scarred with stretch spots and age marks. Our breath and natural odor are revolting to everyone around us. I feel sorry for children who constantly watch television and wonder why they can't have everything that they see. One of the best columns I ever read in the Washington Post by Coleman McCarthy talked about the creative deprivation of our children. Can we creatively deprive our children of things? I can remember my nephew when he was little getting 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 presents for Christmas. By the 10th gift, he no longer knew who sent it or cared about it. He was more interested in playing with the boxes and the ribbons than in the toy itself. We overload our children with things and experiences and wonder why we have so much trouble with them later. A freedom step would be to free ourselves from insatiable appetites. There are two ways to get enough. One is to accumulate more and more stuff, and the other is to desire less and less. And I can tell you from experience that desiring less is a very freeing way to live. Ernst Becker has a quote that I often use. I love it. He says, we're drinking or drugging ourselves into oblivion, or we go shopping, which is the same thing. Now I have to tell a story about my daughter, Karen. When Karen was 15 years old, we lived on an abandoned farm in West Virginia in an area that we call Seldom Seen. Gives you some idea of where it was. 22 miles from the nearest town and the nearest school. Seldom Seen, West Virginia didn't have a lot going for it. We didn't have a television set. Well, we had one, but it just brought in one snowy channel, so you really couldn't see a lot. But we found a lot of other things to do on the farm. We didn't have much money. There were six of us, and our salary was $4,800 a year, which was the only place where we could live because we could grow our own food, chop our own wood, harness a spring, and there was very little expense. So $4,800 was adequate for us. The problem was when Christmas came, and we asked the kids with our fingers crossed, what would you like for Christmas? Well, Karen, being 15, said, I would love a stereo set. Well, our hearts sunk because we knew what a stereo set would cost. But she was 15 years old. We thought every 15-year-old girl deserved to have music in her life. And so we decided we would spend the money to buy Karen a stereo. And we went over the mountain into Virginia, into Stanton, Virginia, and there we went to Kmart, and we bought her a GE record player. It was one of these little blue boxes where you pull out the speakers and they stand next to the box itself. Do you remember those things? With a turntable in the middle. It was $39.95. We bought it, wrapped it up, Christmas came, and Karen was absolutely thrilled. You are the best parents in the world. Oh, I love it. This is exactly what I wanted. It's so wonderful. Oh, thank you. And we felt so good. Her older brothers had gone together and bought her one record. So all the time between Christmas and New Year's, Karen played this one record over and over again, thoroughly enjoying the gift and the gift of music. She was invited to a New Year's Eve party at Susan Lovegrove's house. Now, Susan's father ran the, what was it, Karen? The She's embarrassed. The big Western auto store in the town nearest us in Franklin, West Virginia, they had a very lovely house. Karen was invited to bring her record to Susan's house for the New Year's Eve party. Well, Susan Lovegrove had also gotten a stereo set for Christmas. Hers had quad sound and speakers that hung from four different corners of the room. She had a Marantz changer and a Girard receiver or whatever it was that was so popular then. And she allowed Karen to put her somewhat scratched record on this new stereo that she had received. And I guess the music that came out of that record was incredible. Karen came home from that New Year's Eve party, and the next day she didn't play her record. And the day after that she didn't play her record, and she never played her record the third day. And John and I had taken parent effectiveness training, and we knew that it was very important to get at the basis of what our daughter was feeling. So we said, "Karen, please tell us, why aren't you playing your record?" Our daughter is a very sensitive, beautiful child, and she said, "Well, actually, Susan let me play her record on her machine, and this really doesn't sound very good on mine." And John immediately jumped in with, "You're right, Karen, it's a dink, it's a stupid machine. We never should have spent that little bit of money. You're worth much more. Why did we ever do this?" You know, being a good Lutheran parent, feeling very guilty that we had spent only $39.95 on our daughter. Nothing changed Karen's attitude about that record player, and it wasn't until about a month later that a friend came out from Washington, D.C., who worked at a Radio Shack, and he said, "Karen, I just want to tell you that I am now so hooked that it takes at least $3,000 or $4,000 worth of equipment for me to be satisfied with my stereo set." Now, I don't know whether Karen heard that at age 15 or not, but I sure did. Because when the Marantz Company says this year that their product is great, next year they're going to fire at you. "It's a dink. It really isn't very good. Get rid of it. You need something better. You need something bigger." And so we are constantly dissatisfied. And there is nothing more enslaving than to always wish that you were someone else, that you were somewhere else, or that you had something else. Eric Fromm wrote, "Having fun lies in the satisfaction of consuming and taking in everything. Commodities, sights, food, drinks, cigarettes, people, lectures, books, movies, all are consumed and swallowed. The world is one big object for our appetite, a big apple, a big bottle, a big breast, and we are eternally disappointed." Another great way to look at this freedom thing is that we can withdraw from what Jürgen Lissner called achievement neuroses. The idea that we always have to climb the ladder wherever we are, or get to be a little bit higher in the organization, or feel that we're being a little bit more creative than perhaps we are now. There's not anything wrong with that necessarily, but if it gets to be the reason that we go to work, that we have to achieve and succeed and beat someone else, then it is not a freeing thing. Most of the lifestyle in the United States, I enjoy, I confess it. But some things that we do in this country are not good for our health. We have the highest rate of suicide, divorces, neuroses, psychoses, heart attacks, strokes of any place in the world, and much of it is because of the stress under which we live. This was brought home to us when we lived in the middle of Washington, D.C. in the late 60s. Our neighborhood was integrated. It was basically black and Chicano with some whites that lived at the end of Newport Place. And on Newport Place, there was a retired black man named David Roberts. And David always stood in front of the Newport Market with his arms crossed, and he was kind of the mayor of Newport Place. If you're from a small town, you know that that's the kind of person that sits out in front of the post office or in front of the hardware store and kind of presides over whatever is going on. David Roberts stood there every day, and you said goodbye to him when you went to work in the morning, and he was still there when you came back from work at night, and it was just comfortable to have Mr. David Roberts standing around Newport. During the height of the civil rights movement, Time magazine sent reporters out into the streets of Washington, D.C. to question blacks about the civil rights movement. And one reporter happened to come on Newport Place, and the obvious person to interview was David Roberts. So the reporter went up and said, "Sir, do you think the civil rights movement is making any progress?" And David quickly answered, "I know it is." And the reporter said, "Oh, how can you be so sure?" He said, I just got back from seeing my doctor, and he said I have hypertension. That used to be a white man's disease. That was a kind of a prophetic statement that our neighbor made. I can remember my mom and dad in the Depression saying things like, honey, do you think we can afford what we really need? You've heard that. Now John and I say, do we really need what we can afford? Kavanaugh suggests that we do more celebrating of the riches that we have. Being aware that much of what we have to buy and scratch and scramble for isn't really worth all that much. In fact, he goes so far as to say, we must realize that sometimes the economic system that we live in provides a faith challenge for Christians. Because the economic system says, what kind of person is most suitable for the system in which we live? What kind of person, what kind of behavior is the least desirable in this country? Which kind of people are good for business? Let's suppose that you're a married person with children. If you are relatively happy with your life, if you enjoy spending time with your kids, playing with them, talking with them, if you like nature, if you enjoy sitting in your yard or on your front steps, if your sexual life is relatively happy, if you have a peaceful sense of who you are and are stabilized in your relationships, if you like to pray in solitude, if you just simply enjoy visiting with people, spending time in conversation, if you enjoy living simply, what good are you economically in terms of our system? You haven't spent a nickel. However, if you are unhappy, distressed, if you are living in anxiety or confusion, if you are unsure of yourself and of your relationships, if you find no happiness in your family or sex life, if you can't bear being alone or living simply, you will crave much, you will want more, you will have the behavior most suitable to a social system that is based upon continued economic growth. And that's how our system is. We need to continue to grow economically, and so we have to manufacture needs and then manufacture the goods to meet those manufactured needs. Celebrate in a community if possible. Start sharing things. Does everybody need to own everything? Do you all need waffle irons and aluminum ladders, and do you all need to subscribe to Time? Is there something you can share with your neighbors? Are there things that you can do that are fun, that are more freeing? Don't start with the tough things like three families sharing one car, but start with those things that could be fun and freeing and that will give you a sense of satisfaction and celebration. The third reason that listener listed for changing your lifestyle is for sharing and solidarity with those people in the world that don't have as much. I'm always a little embarrassed to talk to people like ourselves about simplicity of lifestyle because it's a middle-class luxury. Can you imagine two-thirds of the world sitting around talking about simplified lifestyle? They live simply because they have to live simply. In the 1960s and early 70s, when we were in Washington, D.C., we had a symbol, as you all remember, for the civil rights movement, and that symbol was the sit-in. If you thought the law was wrong and knew that the ordinances of that town were wrong because they would not allow blacks and whites to eat at a lunch counter together, you took a black friend and you went to that lunch counter and you sat in. You were there as an act of civil disobedience and as an act of conscience. And so that became a symbol, the sit-in. I would like to suggest that a symbol for the 80s is perhaps a stepping out kind of symbol, where we just say, no, I'm no longer going to get sucked into this. I'm going to step back and I'm going to start deciding what I need. And remember that Jesus said, I will supply all of your needs. Jesus said nothing about supplying our greeds. And so sometimes we haven't decided for ourselves what are our real needs and what are things that I would classify as greeds. And I can't do that for you and you can't do that for me. Everyone must decide for themselves what lifestyle is going to be. What might be not enough for me might be too much for you. and vice versa. Everyone has to decide for themselves. It's so easy to be judgmental when you start talking about lifestyles and you look and say, I wonder why she needed that thing, or why did they buy that, or what they had was certainly good enough. That's not the point. It's that we all look at ourselves and we begin because it is an act of faith. We had a friend who was in a Benedictine monastery for 17 years, and he said every Ash Wednesday, Father Abbot asked the monks to bring a list of everything that they owned. Your shirts, your shoes, your books, your tapes, your plants, your undershirts, your shorts, whatever. You brought Father Abbot a list of the stuff that you had in your room. And then Father Abbot would go through this list and say, Dunstan, you don't need four pair of shoes. You don't need this. You don't need that. You can get those books in the library. You can share this with your brother down the hall. There are other people in Washington, D.C. who need those things. And so Dunstan would have to go back to his room and take out all the stuff that Father Abbot said he didn't need. Well, I don't want Father Abbot coming into my house and saying, Mary, you've got six sweaters. You don't need that many. Or you don't need that many pair of shoes, or how many nightgowns do you really need? Decide for yourself what enough is. I started by just saying, what do I need in my wardrobe? Sid Simon, who writes all those books on values clarifications, did the same thing, and he decided that four shirts were enough. He lives in a very small apartment. He travels most of the time. He said, I don't have room to stock or to hang up more than four shirts. I have a couple that, when they get dirty, I have a couple that are clean. I don't need more than four. Now, obviously, four shirts would not be enough for most of you in this room. And when people said, but Mr. Simon, when somebody gives you a new shirt, what do? And he said, then I throw one away. Or, I mean, I give one to someone else. I take it to Goodwill or Salvation Army. The good thing about moving is that you deaccumulate. You get rid of all that stuff. You have a garage sale. You take big loads of things down to Goodwill. Well, maybe we could start to deaccumulate monthly. Or just say, this is my wardrobe. This is what I need. It's just such a small first step, but it all of a sudden gets in your consciousness. And I know from my own personality, if I am bored or frustrated, I go down to the shopping mall after I have gone to the refrigerator. And I walk up and down Rosedale Mall, and I might not even buy anything, but there is something so stimulating about taking my bag and just going and looking at everything. And sometimes I come out of there unscathed, and I congratulate myself, and I say, I made it. I didn't buy a thing today. Isn't that wonderful? And I am so proud of myself. But if I had not made for myself a list of the things I actually need, I was so proud of my daughter Kathy last month. She said, Mom, I saw the most gorgeous pink cashmere coat. It was a, $200 coat, and it was on sale for $50. She said, I almost bought it. She's a very petite person, and you know those small sizes are always on sale. But she said, I decided I didn't need it, and I could have hugged her. Because I hope my kids have learned that. Decide what the things are that you need and separate them from your greeds. That's one way you can show solidarity with people who have less. Just say, I really can be very happy and not always have to be having more and more things. Irma Bombeck had a column once. I wish I had brought it along. I just love her humor. She said she was visiting one day in the beauty parlor, and someone said, I'll bet you're an autumn, aren't you? And she said, well, actually, I do like cooler weather. And the woman said, no, you're an autumn. And she said, do you mean to tell me you've never been draped? And Irma said, obviously, I was the last woman in America not to know what being draped meant. And the woman said, oh, you go and they put up these swatches of material against you and they tell you what colors really make a statement and which colors just having you fade into the background. It's very important, and then they give you this spectrum of colors and you carry it with you and you never leave the house without your color spectrum and you consult it before you buy absolutely anything. And Irma said, well, I went and was draped. And I discovered that the best colors for me are beige and gray. She said, the sad thing was that there were only two articles of clothing in my wardrobe that I could wear. One was a beige t-shirt that said, "Too many men, too little time." And the other was a gray nightgown that had gotten thrown in by mistake with my son's jeans. And then she said, "The thing I decided I would have to do is join the army because I discovered that khaki is also a very good color with my complexion." I talked about that story at a women's ALCW retreat one time, only to discover that in the afternoon, one of the main workshops was a woman who was coming out to drape all these pastors' wives. Another way we can show, we can share and show solidarity by the way that we live and by understanding justice is to look at our wastefulness. Our daughter Kathy is a flight attendant for Northwest Airlines, and I checked this out with her this evening, but you have to have enough food on the plane for anyone that may have made a reservation. And if 20 people don't show up on the plane and that food isn't used, by law, it is thrown out. In fact, if any flight attendant even so much as takes a bag of peanuts off the airplane, he or she can be fired. So you are not allowed to use that food. It is all thrown away. We have built-in wastefulness. Or I hate to pick on McDonald's, but I need to tell you that a fast food store like McDonald's has in their manual for the manager that if coffee is in the pot more than 20 minutes, it has to be thrown out. If French fries are there longer than 8 minutes, they get thrown out, and hamburgers get tossed after 10 minutes. Now, if you're a good manager, you're not going to have much waste at McDonald's. But the fact of the matter is, McDonald's has that because as a customer, if I go in, I want a cup of coffee that doesn't taste like the bottom of the barrel, and I want French fries that are crisp and hot, and I want a hamburger that doesn't have a soggy bun in it. And so to make sure that McDonald's even has now the lettuce and tomato in this big plastic container on one side and your hamburger on the other. Look at the waste and the way that we package things. I recommend a book to you. It's Margaret's out of it in the bookstore right now, but it's a very thin little book that Herald Press puts out. It's called Add Justice to Your Shopping List. And it talks about the things that we buy in the grocery store and where they come from and the oppression that might occur because we buy certain things and how you can avoid doing that or how you can do something about your conscience by having your own little Central America kitty at home where you put extra money into it or something if you buy bananas from the Banana Republic. But the grocery store is so set up that you have to shop the perimeters of the grocery store. If you just did that, that's probably most of what you need, your produce, your dairy products, your meats, your eggs, your milk, and so forth. But if they put those things right in the middle of the store as you came in the store, you'd head right for those, and you wouldn't walk past the hamburger helper and the very exotic Duncan Hines cake mixes and all of those microwave popcorn things and stuff that we probably wouldn't buy, but we see it because we don't just skip along the outside of the grocery store. We go the quickest way, which is right through the middle, and on the way we discover that our shopping cart has a lot of other things. That's just one simple idea, but just be aware when you go shopping what you're doing and what you're buying. We waste energy. 21% of the energy use in this country goes to change the temperatures of our rooms. 21% to heat them in the winter and to cool them down in the summer. And we never think of doing like the Norwegians doing in Minneapolis anyway, and wearing long underwear. And because if you did, then you go into a store and you're just sweating because it's so hot, and then you go outside and you're freezing. We haven't learned to dress properly. I confess that I worship a God of convenience. I'm willing to change my lifestyle until it's no longer convenient. And then I say, oh, well, what difference does it make? And that bothers me because I know if all of us stopped worshiping the God of convenience, much of the junk that people try to get us to buy would not be purchased, and perhaps they would stop making it. Before you purchase something, think of the resources that it took not only to make it, but to use that product. Now, don't misunderstand me. God doesn't want us to live miserably or in poverty. God wants us all to live with sufficiency. I think the most beautiful paradigm for this is the Exodus story of manna. You remember every morning God sent these little things that looked like pigeon droppings. The children of Israel would go out and pick them up. And God said, now, if you need a lot, take a lot. If you don't need quite so much, don't take so much. And so every morning the children of Israel went out and they gathered manna, and those that had larger families and needed more took more, and those that needed less took less. And no one had too much, and no one had too little. The problem was with the people that took more than they needed. And you remember what happened to the manna? It rotted, and the stench went up to heaven. And I'd like to suggest that God perhaps smells a lot of rotting manna now when we take more than we really need instead of living with sufficiency and with an understanding of freedom and sharing and solidarity. And in Luke, when Jesus talks about God's providence for us, he does so with an illustration of a bushel basket overflowing with grain and shaken down, and just a marvelous bushel basket full of grain. The problem is that when that basket gets full, we get a bigger basket and we go to God and say, God, you did a great job filling up this basket. Let's see what you can do with the next size. And if by some providence of God or some of God's blessings to us, that basket gets filled, we are dissatisfied and we bring an even bigger basket and we say, okay, God, now let's see what you can do with this basket. And we continue to be eternally dissatisfied. Last reason for changing our lifestyle, listener suggests, is witness and provocation. Provocation, that word meaning to call forth a response from other people. Peter wrote to the early Christians that they should always be prepared to answer to the hope that is within them. I think Peter assumed that Christians would be living so differently from the rest of society that people would come up and say, you know, you're a very different person than these other people around. Why do you live the way you do? How long has it been since someone came up to you and said, why do you live the way you do? I think it's a very important way to witness, not that you bang people over the head with it, but if you are kind of kooky and are a peculiar person, as we are asked to be, and we are leaven and light and we stand out in society because we are trying to live more simply with gentle justice as the center of our spirituality, people are going to ask us about that, and we can answer to the hope that is within us. I'm embarrassed that more people don't come up and say, Mary, why do you live the way you do? When Paul writes to the Ephesians, he says, or the Philippians, he said, let your moderation be seen by all people. That word moderation is epiakes in the Greek. And that word can be translated fitting in. I think Paul is saying to the Philippians, let your fitting in be seen by all people. Let them see that you understand that there are poor people, that there are oppressed people, that God has created a world where there is enough. Not that we have to live in deprivation and in poverty, but with sufficiency. Lifestyle changes are only a first step. They're not a substitute for political action or any of the other ways that we do justice. But I do not think that you are going to do anything in your life that is inconsistent with the way that you live. If you keep a gun in your house to protect your stuff, you're not going to work for disarmament. If you don't look at your eating habits and try to train your children to perhaps eat more nutritiously and lower on the food scale, then you're probably not going to be interested in doing much for bread for the world. If you don't live with some risk, then you're probably going to have a lot of insurance and bonds and stocks, and you're not going to be willing to go out there and risk much or be in a position where you're the least bit insecure. And so I think lifestyle steps enable us to take bigger steps because we realize that there is a consistency, that if I change the way I live, Perhaps then I can work for bigger things. Don't let the world squeeze you into its mold, Paul says. There is a very subtle idolatry in consumerism because I think it comes down to a matter of where is your trust? Was Jesus just stupidly naive to say, look at the lilies, take no thought for the morrow, seek first God's kingdom and God's justice, and then all the rest of the stuff will be added? If we just took that one verse from Matthew, seek first God's kingdom and God's righteousness, which is also translated justice, then we can be assured that the rest of what we need to live will be given to us by a gracious God. Look at the things that enslave you. We live with some illusions in this country. Bigger is better, faster is better, more convenient is better. Pain is to be avoided at all costs. Take care of number one, pull your own strings. New fashions are a must. I think it boils down simply to that matter of trust, because consumerism does battle for our souls. I'd like to close with an Ivan Illich quote. He says, we can only live changes. We can't think our way into a new society or a new humanity. Every one of us, every group with which we work, must become a model of the new era we hope to create. The many models which we'll develop should give each of us an environment in which we can celebrate our potential and discover the way to a more humane world. Two suggestions if in your congregation you would like to study this subject. One is an excellent book by John V. Taylor. He is an Anglican bishop in England. It's called Enough is Enough. And it was an underground letter that he wrote to the priests in his diocese. And it was so popular that it soon became a book. It makes a marvelous study guide. And Augsburg published the American edition, and John and Chuck Lutz have put in the back of it a good study guide for congregational use. And then there is another book that's put out by four denominations, the Episcopal, Presbyterian, UCC, and Methodist, called A Covenant Group for Lifestyle Assessment. And it's a 12-week study on the way that we can live together in our congregations with more simplicity. It has biblical studies. It has ways of sharing and solidarity with one another. It looks at how we spend our leisure. Either of those books would be excellent resources for you if you're interested. I purposely didn't allow much time for discussion because I think it's very difficult in this large auditorium to discuss much. But before people start coming in for Vespers, does somebody want to argue with me or make a suggestion or share what they do in their own lives or any comments at all? I think the most difficult households to live simply are those with teenage kids. I mean, it's just really hard. I mean, we dragged ours out to the boondocks in West Virginia just to get them away from a lot of that cultural stuff. I don't know whether they suffered for it or not, but creative deprivation is very hard to do when you have kids. That peer pressure is incredible. That's why it's so important that you work in communities of people. And I hope that your faith community is your congregation, where you can get together with other parents and talk it over. If John always says, if you're going to be kooky in this society, have a couple of other people to be really kooky with you. Or you're also paranoid. You know, you can't just stand out there by yourself. You've got to have some help and support. That's probably why John and I have chosen ever since 1965 to live in community. We just don't feel we can live the way we want to by ourselves. It's just too hard. Other things. As long as they're Calvin Kleins or something. Okay. Yes.
I agree with your theme 100%.
Right. There will always be social adjustments that have to be made, and those on the low end of the employment and the money making in this country will always suffer most. I'm reminded, though, that Bishop Tutu said, yes, sanctions will hurt us in South Africa, but we have always been living in and suffering. Now we will suffer with hope. And we do have to address that problem of new jobs and things that maybe create a healthier, better educated society than making things that we don't need. The Stanford Research Center did a study about 15 years ago, and said it was on the business page of the New York Times, just saying people are really changing their buying habits. They're not going to continue to buy the junk that manufacturers make anymore, and you need to start looking at things that are made with care and that are lasting and durable and not always thrown away. I mean, it's, you know, it's hard to find a razor or a pen anymore that isn't a throwaway kind of thing, or typewriter ribbons or whatever. We just come to expect that. Yes. Thank you. One more comment. Yeah.
You know, here at Synod Convention and all, the church at large addresses the most prominent social issues in some way, whether or not it's effective. They seem to be addressed. South Africa, the main thing. But these kinds of things that make so much sense to hear them, in my experience, are not addressed by the church at large, where the difference could really be made, where papers could be, statements could come out from the church at large that encourages members of the Christian community to respond in lifestyles like this. It doesn't happen. I guess I'm searching for the question of why and how. You know, we as lay people can encourage that to happen in the church at large. A statement needs to be made for everybody to hear and everybody to take very seriously. And then I think we'll filter down to those other major issues that always seem to be on the top of the agenda.
Well, I think it's very threatening, as I said at the beginning. And there are some things that are out, but I agree. Just along that line, a group from our community in Minneapolis went down to the SAC base in Omaha to be part of that demonstration last month. And they expected the keynote speaker, with 600 people there who were at a retreat before they went and demonstrated against militarism, to say, you know, this is really good. I'm glad you're going to be arrested. It's great to have civil disobedience. Instead, he said, you know, it's all right if you want to do this, but I think there's a much more important issue if we want to see peace and justice in this world, and that's that you all go home and you change your lifestyles. That isn't being said very often or by very many people, and I think it needs to be said more, so I agree. Thank you very much for your attention.